Minnesota Reads on Northland Morning is produced at KUMD with funding provided in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Our guest this morning is Christine Moran. She has written a book called Ecology Without Culture, Aesthetics for a Toxic World. Academic publications can really be a challenge if you're not taking the class and sitting in the room with the instructor as they explain a lot of the concepts. But there was something about the title and the description of this book that fascinated me. And luckily, we have the author on the line to shed a little bit of light on the subject. I've been learning all kinds of new things, Christine, including the concept of eco-criticism. Can you tell us what that's about?
Hi, Lisa. Good to talk with you, and thanks for taking a look at my book. I did try to make it readable, and I think this book emerges out of my interest in thinking about ecological problems through literature. I'm originally trained as a literature scholar, and I've been reading Japanese literature in particular, mostly from the 1860s to the present. And in my reading of these texts and in my training, I'm usually asked to mostly think about human values, human culture, what political ideas are at work in the literature. Eco-criticism asks us to think more about the material world in literature and in cinema as well, or to think about how nature is represented or even how animals are represented in literature, among other things.
It's a really interesting, I'd not heard the word before, so I had to look it up. And of course, the internet is, you know, it's full of nonsense, but it's also full of lots of interesting information. And it says, you know, that it's the study of literature in the environment from an interdisciplinary point of view, which is fascinating when you start to bring in additional perspectives and how literature treats the subject of nature. And of course, there are so many, many different ways to approach these topics. Where your book is really focusing is the idea of removing human beings and removing culture from, you know, and what happens if you do that from some of these examinations. And it strikes me right off the top of my head that in this current day and age could be a dangerous kind of idea to bring forward.
Right. Well, I'm hoping that we have a number of examples that we could turn to where people from different groups or collectivities sort of come together around an issue related to the biological world, such as water, to show us that the total is more than the sum of its parts. So if we imagine that we're doing, let's say, an environmental practice for the sake of our particular culture, right, then we're identifying with our particular culture, and it doesn't really enable a kind of reaching out, you know, a reaching out to, let's say, a different collectivity which may have its own, let's say, cultural interests or values. So that's one of the ideas.
And that is a fascinating idea because America has become, in many ways, went from the idea of the melting pot, where everybody kind of abandoned certain parts of their own backgrounds to create this new thing together. And that wasn't working out so well for some groups. And so people have kind of retreated. They've kind of moved backwards and started to kind of clutch their cultural identities close. And in many instances, you can really see why they've done that. Cultural identities in some areas, even in this country, are very tied up with the idea of a connection to nature or a connection to the land. And I guess that's what I had in mind when I said that could be kind of a dangerous idea to put forward.
Yeah, and certainly we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And certainly we have really important ideas of you know, caring for the biotic world, the material world, then they have a longish history to them. But if the goal is the preservation of a culture, then we haven't necessarily used those ideas in an innovative approach at a time when so many of us, most of us, are in some way involved in, you know, consumerism.
Right.
Yeah, and so we can't really deny at this point that we have some involvement in use of resources. And so how can we better understand our current place in the globe geopolitically without sort of worrying about our cultural identity dissipating, you know, into that?
Right, because there's more than one way of looking at culture. A culture could be my people came from Scandinavia, you know, 150 years ago, or my culture could be I drive my car to work every day and I like to buy stuff. So there are yeah. lots of different ways to look at culture and how it does impact on the environment. And I get a kick out of the line. Because I sort of translated it myself, that came in the news release with this book, that said that you ultimately contend that the chief stumbling block to ecological thinking is not the image of nature, but the image of culture. And I mentally translated that to the chief stumbling block to ecological thinking is people and their issues, not our natural world. Is that a fair translation?
I think so. I mean, originally I was writing a little bit against a philosopher named Timothy Morton, who wrote a book called Ecology Without Nature. And his argument was, we think of nature as something out there, you know, the wilderness or this romantic transcendental idea, something beyond the human. And that's the problem. That's keeping us from thinking eco-critically. And what I'm saying is, no, I think we don't need to refer to the sort of 19th century romantic way of thinking about nature to criticize ourselves about whether we're thinking eco-critically. I think it does make sense to rather really dig down deep and figure out, you know, where culture and eco-critical thinking fit. And that's why I wrote Ecology Without Culture. I think you're exactly right when you say or suggest that I'm saying humans and their issues are what's at stake. You know, the interests of the material world, how do we articulate those? If we're always worried about reinforcing our cultural beliefs and our cultural notions, can we make room for thinking about the interests of the material world, animal species, and so on? That's one of the questions of the book.
Because those are to an extent, depending on how far down the philosophy rabbit hole you want to fall, there are cultures there too, but those are not cultures that can enter into the dialogue. So what room do we make, or do we make room for those that cannot enter into the dialogue?
So you're talking about those who don't use human language?
Yeah.
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 Right. So that's one of the ideas. So the first part of the book talks more about culture with regard to, say, sovereignty, you know, cultural sovereignty, national sovereignty for particular cultures. And a lot of the book really focuses on the problem of not just culture, but cultural humanism. That is to say, that idea where we imagine that ultimately we're working toward the best for humanity. What is the degree to which we can, or how can we think beyond, you know, values of things and the world for entities beyond humanity, beyond cultural humanism? That's one of the questions of the book.
And if that is a question, and that's a question that I think a lot of people like to grapple with every so often, is humanity the be-all and the end-all, and should that be the way we make these decisions, or do we need to broaden our scope a little bit? It's a fascinating read. Christine, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Minnesota Reads.
Oh, thank you so much, Lisa, for having me.
I'm really glad to have you with us. Thanks. Christine Marin is the author of a book called Ecology Without Culture, Aesthetics for a Toxic World, and she joined us this morning on Minnesota Reads. Minnesota Reads is produced at KUMD with funding provided in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.